All right, Genesis chapter 16 is where we're going to pick up again. And, the opening shot, I just remind you that these things are happening to Abram and Sarai, that Sarah, here at Hebron, which is in the West Bank now. So it's Palestinian territory, hard to get in there. But in the picture, the Herodian enclosure is around the Machpelah cave. So that was put up in the first century BC. This is the cave of the patriarchs, the burial site for both Abraham and Sarah, as well as a couple more generations after that. So we know that ancient Hebron was here, just a little bit on the west side of there. And you can kind of see the ruins from that time period. But as we start tonight, I want us to remember the names of our key players here. Abram means high father or exalted father. I actually think that he was probably named by his dad in honor of his dad, who had recently passed away. So grandpa had passed away, and so Abram gets named after him, in a way. Then we've got, I've been saying Sarai because that's just the way it looks in English, but her actual Hebrew name at this time is Sarai. And it means princess. It's the diminutive of what you would say about a woman of high rank. So the little girl who's going to grow up to be the lady of great prominence. So that'll be, both of those names are going to be important before we get done with our lesson tonight, I think. So Abram was 75 when they came to Canaan, and Sarai was 65 when they arrived. So only 10 years apart in age. They're half brother and sister. Now, in the story tonight, it takes place 10 years later after their arrival. So they really haven't been believers in the one true God for a terribly long period of time. Because more than likely, they were engaged by God just a few years before they headed off to Canaan. So I'm guessing probably less than 15 years they've really known God. So we should think of them as fairly young in the faith. They don't have a lot of experience interacting with people that have been in the faith a long time. In fact, I told you, I think that their interaction with the priest at Salem, Melchizedek, that was probably their best interaction with somebody that had been in the faith for a good long time. So they are in process of becoming the people we know as the faithful father and mother of the faith whenever we get to the New Testament. Now, chapter 16 follows hot on the heels with the event we talked about last week, where God goes through this ceremony. Remember that? Had the bloody trail with the pieces of the three animals and the two birds separated, making a path to walk through. Very common practice back in this time to cut a covenant, and two people making that agreement would walk the path together, and the intimation was, may this be done to me if I do not keep my part of this bargain. May I be killed. But God didn't allow Abram to walk the path with him. That's very important. So Abram's only responsibility is to trust God. That's his responsibility. We would use the word have faith. God is the one that's going to carry out the promises. Now, do you remember, off the top of your head, little pop quiz here, What are the promises that God has made to Abram up to this point? There's two key ones. Let's see if you can grab hold of both of them. All right. He is going to be the father of... Right. More children than he'd want to count. Do you remember what the connection was? What was he looking at when God said, you're going to have more kids than that? The stars up in the sky. And so... That is one of the chief promises. And God went, the scripture says, Abram believed God, trusted God, and that was counted as righteousness. And we went to the New Testament places where that was used. Comes right out of chapter 15 of Genesis. What was the other thing? Do you remember? The land of Canaan is going to be there. Now, I actually count that as part of the multitude of descendants. It's kind of part A and part B. You're going to have a lot of kids, and they're all going to live in this land. So there's really only one more. And it wasn't just something that he said most recently. It was something that he told Abram before they ever left to come to the promised land. You managed to come up with one I didn't count. Okay, we'll count that one too. The Abrahamic blessing. The Abrahamic blessing, which is exactly as you quoted it. I'm going to bless those that bless you, and I'm going to curse those that curse you. So a special protection, a bubble of protection around Abram. Nope, it's not clicking, is it? In your seed... all the nations of the earth are going to be blessed. That was from the very beginning. God was telling him something about a future descendant, a singular future descendant, that was going to make a huge difference in the entire world. And of course, we know that's Jesus. And that's a very important part of this whole story. But all of this is... you know, kind of, it's all determined or it's all connected with Abram has to have a kid, right? And God told him when Abram had suggested, well, I'll just adopt one of my servants. He'll be my seed. And God says, no, it's going to be the son of your body. That was the last thing we kind of saw before we now come to chapter 16. So in my imagination, I picture that Abram goes and has a conversation with Sarai about everything God just told him. And Sarai processes that. And so chapter 16 starts with the climax of her thinking process. Chapter 16, 1. Now, Sarai, Abram's wife. There we go. I'm playing around with the language a lot now. Had borne him no children. Now, I don't know how long they've been married, but we know later descendants of theirs are married by the time they get 40. So even if we took that as our number, these two could have been married for 30 plus years, 40 plus years, and they have no kids. But she had an Egyptian maid whose name was Hagar. Now, where do you think this Egyptian maid came from? Egypt! Have they been in Egypt? Yes! About 10 years ago, remember they arrived in Canaan, and what was happening in Canaan at that time? Oh, you've forgotten. There was a drought going on, a famine. So they decided, let's go down to Egypt, because Egypt doesn't typically suffer whenever there is meteorological disruptions in the Middle East, because they get their water from the Nile, which gets its water from way down south in deep Africa. And so they went down there, had a little misunderstanding about whether Sarai was sister or wife, remember that? And then they are asked to leave. Well, it would appear that during that brief period of time they were down there, they ended up either hiring a female servant to help Sarai out, or they purchased her indebtedness contract, what we often refer to as slavery. So if a person or a family gets into dire straits financially, they will end up having an indebtedness that they can only pay off by physical service. And so this is the general way that people became slaves back in the Old Testament times. Every once in a while, when wars happened, and the losing side ends up being invaded, war reparations, that is paying the bills for losing, might include citizens or people living in the losing country helping pay that bill off by becoming slaves. So Hagar is either hired on or her indebtedness contract is purchased, and she becomes one of many female servants working for Sarai. Now, another little trivia question, see if you can remember. Do you remember how many adult men were working for Abraham that had been born in his or his father's tent cities? Do you remember what that number was? Give me a round number if you can think of. How much? It was not quite 400. It was 318. So 300 servants born to the families that they already had hired working for them. So you can extrapolate that into many more hundreds that must have been working in the tent city employ of Abram. And if that's the case for Abram, who's running all the sheep and the goats and the camels and the donkeys, you know, doing all that, how many servants must Sarai have running around Tent City making sure that meals are cooked and new clothing is made? You know, all the things that were part of the home encampment economy. So, you know, Sarai's got several hundred people working for her. And Hagar is one of them. But there is an interesting thing about Hagar. She is not married. She is single. And that's important to the story here. Because Sarai said to Abram, "Now behold, the Lord," or God, Most High, "has prevented me from bearing children." Now, do we know that for absolute sure? No. But that's commonly assumed, right? By people. I mean, even when people today can't have children, sometimes they'll say, "Why has God done this to me?" Right? That's not a guarantee that God did it to you. But that's a common expression. And so she starts with that assumption, and then she makes this suggestion. And it is based on her growing up in Mesopotamia. It's pretty sure about that. because there was a law from this time period in Mesopotamia that if the lady of the household could not bear a child to the lord of the household, then the lady of the household could designate a young woman, unmarried woman, to become a secondary wife to her husband, and that the son that was born from that union would be counted as the lady's son. It was an ancient form of surrogacy. And therefore, all of the inheritance would go to that son, and the lady of the house would basically raise the son as her own. Now, mom would still be there as a secondary wife, and having input into the life of her biological child, but the one who would call all the shots would be the lady of the household. Because the legal arrangement in Mesopotamia was the child was hers. In fact, they would go so far as to do this. This is, are you ready for kind of a weird ceremony? When the time of delivery would happen, the lady of the household would sit on the birthing stool, because that's how they would do a lot of this. And then she would have the surrogate mom sit on her lap. And so when the baby was born, it was born with the adopted mom right there, being involved in the birth. That's how significant a legal connection is going on here. And so that is what Sarai is recommending at this point. She says, go into my maid. Perhaps I will obtain children through her. And Abram listened to the voice of Sarai. Now, all of us can critique him, and that's perfectly fine. Why didn't he go check in with God, right? Because that would have solved an awful lot of this problem. But he didn't. And I think some of that might be for the fact that he's not really been a believer for all that long. Well, because, let me repeat the comment. I keep saying this idea that he's not been a believer very long. Where do I get that idea? Well, Genesis chapter 12, which is the beginning of Abram's story, is that he is told that he needs to leave Ur of Chaldees and go to a land that God will show him. And so there seems to be this indication that needs to happen now. You need to go. But we also have information from the book of Genesis that Abram's father and his brother both seemed to go along with him out of Ur of Chaldees. And it seems to be that they believed in the same God, and they seemed that they were going to follow the same path and head wherever it is that God had indicated. But they only got as far as about 30 or so miles away to Haran. And then they stopped. And they remained there until Terah, the father, died. And immediately after Terah was dead, that's when Abraham went the rest of the way south, according to God's commandment, and arrived in Canaan. And we know that that happened when he was 75 years old. So you put the other two things together, and it seems as if there were probably only a couple of years involved in that process of, I need you guys to go to a land I'm going to show you. And they started on their way, but then a hiccup happened. And they didn't continue any farther until Terah died. Because Abram and Terah didn't know God until God introduced himself to them in Genesis chapter 12. Before that, they believed in other gods and goddesses. They were polytheists. We're told this in other places of the Bible. They did not believe in the one true God until the one true God introduced himself to them, starting in Genesis chapter 12. And so that's why I say that probably 15 years or so, I think probably 15 years at the most, is how long Abram has been serving God, and Sarai has been there as well in it. So that's why I think we see him acting with not the full maturity we would expect from someone that we know in later passages as being the father of the faith. Because, if I can be a little bit flippant about it, his maturity is not all cooked yet. He's just beginning here. I mean, after all, we talked about the fact that he's not going to learn about don't pass your wife off as your sister. He's going to repeat that again. So that, again, shows that he's not quite fully mature in his carrying out of moral things. He's in process. He's a work in process. Now, I became a Christian when I was a little kid, and so I knew that I had more maturing to do. But a lot of times, people who become Christians as adults, it takes them a little bit longer because they got a lot of bad habits and things that have to be dealt with. So it doesn't surprise me terribly much that Abram just simply heard what Sarai said and matched it against what he also knew was the common practice of Mesopotamia and went, sounds like a good idea to me. Let's do it. Because the only thing that God had said to him recently was, no, you're going to have a child from your own body. That doesn't mean Sarai has to be involved in it then, does it? So he, I think, may have thought, yeah, this works. This is how God is going to give me a child of my own body, is by using this legal practice of surrogacy. And I think it would have been more helpful if he'd checked in, but he didn't. But we have other examples of that, of people that it would have been a lot better if they'd checked in with God, but they didn't, right? And then later, problems arise. And it can happen even to mature people that are having bad days. You know, when I say the name Jonah, what do you immediately think? Big fish swallows him, because why? He wouldn't go and do what God told him to do. But you understand that he, at that time, was already well known as a powerful prophet of God. But he allowed his own feelings and attitude to kind of hijack his past faith. And it got him in trouble. And thankfully, though, he eventually did what he was told to do, and great things happened from that. So one of the things about the Bible is it tells us the stories of these people as real people. And real people don't always have great days. Sometimes they have off days, even the best of them. So Abram listened to the voice of Sarai. Now, little trivia question. That phrase, the sound of it there, Abram listened to the voice of his wife. Does that sound a tiny bit familiar? Adam and Eve. That's exactly right. Because when God starts handing out the penalties, he says, because you listen to the voice of your wife, and then it's implied, rather than mine, this is what's going to have to happen. And so here we have kind of another example of it would have been better to check in with God. Verse number 3, after Abram had lived 10 years in the land of Canaan, so that's where we get the chronology, Abram's wife Sarai took Hagar, the Egyptian, her maid, and gave her to her husband Abram as his wife. And so you see the technical language. This is a real marriage. It's all legal according to the Mesopotamian standards. And so all this is above board as far as, you know, these guys have lived. And so it's not an affair. That's not what's looked at as. It is looked at as he now has two wives, one that can't have children, and the other that's going to have children on behalf of the one that can't have children. That's how it's looked at. Got a picture here. Maybe this will help you visualize some things. This is an 11th dynasty statue of an Egyptian female slave or servant. So 11th dynasty, right around the time we're thinking about right now. So maybe that's Hagar right there. And instead of having to carry lots and lots of things around and doing things all the time for Sarai, Sarai's now tapped her to do a special mission. Get pregnant on my behalf. That's weird from our culture. It really is. But it was quite common for their time period. So here's where the problem starts. He went into Hagar after the marriage ceremony, and she conceived. Just like that, very quickly. And when she saw that she had conceived, her mistress was despised in her sight. Why? What's the attitude that's going on here? Exactly. I can do what you can't. Which means what in her mind? I'm better than you. And if I'm better than you, why should you get to boss me around? Why should you be in charge? Seems like if I'm the one that's going to have the babies, I should be the senior wife. Right? Can you hear that attitude or think about that attitude? So when Sarai says, Hagar, you need to go in and loom some clothing for all the people in the encampment. She goes, I don't want to. Why not? Because I think it might hurt me. I'm pregnant. I want to carry the Lord's child carefully here. You know, you can use your imagination, right? Where she would start being that way. And do servants talk to each other? Oh, yeah. And do you think maybe she had some things to say in the background that might have disrespected Sarai? Yeah, I wouldn't be a bit surprised. And so that doesn't go over well. So verse number 5, Sarai said to Abram, may the wrong done to me be upon you. I gave my maid into your arms, but when she saw that she had conceived, I was despised in her sight. May the Lord judge between you and me. Now, do you find something odd about that? Anything? Passing the buck how? Well, why is that a problem, blaming him? I mean, after all, he slept with handmaid. What am I digging at? Who suggested all of this to begin with? She did. Now, he agreed, so he's definitely a participant in this. But she is the one that started the ball rolling. And so she holds him responsible for letting this happen. And she's mad at him. She's mad at him. She's mad at Hagar. She's mad at the whole situation. She's apparently even a little bit mad at God, right? Because earlier, who did she blame for her, the fact that she can't have kids? God. Abram said back to Sarai, "Behold, your maid is in your power. Do to her what is good in your sight." So now you find out a little bit something here about the culture of the time. In the Bedouin society, because that's basically what this is. In the Bedouin society, the lord of the tent city ran everything revolved around husbandry, you know, taking care of the animals and digging the wells and selling and buying and all of that interchange between other tent city groups. The lady of the tent city ran everything else. So Sarai she's the boss of all of her slaves. And that's what Abram says. He says, "I'm not her boss. You deal with her the way you think needs to happen." And so apparently Sarai treated her harshly. Now, what's meant by that? Well, she may have given her even harder jobs, some of the junk jobs, instead of the more cushy things. But she also could have penalized her, you know, taken away privileges and things. Because in this society, you know, this is a Bedouin society in the tent city, you need everybody pulling their weight. And so you use carrot and stick approach sometimes to get all that done. She starts getting things that she doesn't like. Eventually, Hagar decides she's had enough of that nonsense, and she's out of there. Verse number 6 says also that she fled from her presence. Ah, good question. How old was Hagar? We don't know. We have no clue. She is clearly of childbearing age. She wasn't married, which makes me think that she was younger than average. I always picture her somewhere in her 20s or 30s. That's how I picture her. Probably not too far from, you know, our little statue here. I'm guessing that person's in their 20s or so. Okay? She runs away. Now, this is where we pull out our map. Remember our big map with all the major highways? Not super highways like we drive on, but good highways that you can take carts and wheeled vehicles down. Let's zoom in. You see Hebron up in the right-hand corner, correct? That's where all this is happening. You see the blue going along the coast there? That's the ancient highway of the sea. That's the trade route that is heavily traveled from Mesopotamia to Egypt. And so my guess is that the best thing that Hagar could have done if she were wanting to run away home, because where is she from? Egypt. So the shortest route for her would be to head one day's easy walk due west till she hits that highway and then follows it for the next week until she's home. That would have been the quick way. But she'd be able to be tracked down pretty easily that way, right? So instead, she does this. She heads south. Now, there's no roads anywhere near no major roads anywhere near Hebron until you get way down south. And that's the thing. I don't know. The word that's used for her can be either somebody that's serving out an indebtedness contract, which would be a slave, or somebody who has entered into a contract of employment for a period of time, which sometimes we'd refer to as an indentured servant. I don't know which. That's another thing, isn't it? And what's she carrying inside of her? The heir to the tenth city. So she can be pretty certain she's going to be followed. They're going to look for her. It depended on the culture at the time. And I don't really know from this time period whether or not they were marked with that, any type of thing like that. There would be something equivalent to bounty hunters that would do that sort of stuff, sure. So you can, on this map, you can kind of see a little bit of the terrain, right? It's kind of hilly and things like that, but that's kind of deceptive because we got a nice green here. That's not appropriate. Do you see where the S is in Tanis? Off to the left. You see the little, there's a little bit of water just to the right of the S. That's the edge of the delta. So everything to the left of there, everything to the west of there, it'd be nice and green. But everything to the west of there, all the way over to Hebron, it's dry desert. It's the Negev. Which the word Negev means dry. And so if you strike out across this open territory, this open terrain, on a secondary or tertiary road, you better know where all the oases are. You better know which tracks are the actual path to those oases and which ones are goat tracks that go off in, you know, to the hills. So she's apparently trying to strike out across that desert region so that she can connect up with the other major road that goes across to Egypt. And this would have been the better way to go if she wanted to not be so easily found, because she could disappear pretty quick. But she's got to get across at least a week's worth of desert in order to do that. So she runs into a problem right about there, just a day or so south of Hebron. Verse number 7. Now, the angel of the Lord found her by a spring of water in the wilderness, by the spring on the way to Shur. So she does have water because she's found one of these springs, but this is the type of terrain she's going through. That's the Negev. Anybody want to trek across that? Israelis do it all the time as wilderness trekkers. But they follow very specific paths. And they carry lots of water with themselves, plus telephones and things to make sure that if they get in trouble, they can call for assistance. So here she is. She's out here, and she's finally stopped by a place where there's a pool of water, and the angel of God catches up with her. Verse number 8, he said to her, Hagar, Sarai's maid, where have you come from? And where are you going? And she said, I'm fleeing from the presence of my mistress, Sarai. And then the angel of the Lord said to her, return to your mistress and submit yourself to her authority. So now God steps in and basically tells her, knock it off, go back. go back and stow the attitude. I think that's kind of implied here. Because that's what got her in trouble with Sarai, wasn't it? So go back and behave yourself. And then the angel said to her, now, this is one of the first places we see this. I will greatly multiply your seed. You see that? Now, it's the angel of the Lord that's doing the talking here. And a lot of people will go, well, that's because this is Jesus. And they always assume that the angel of the Lord is Jesus. And I don't think that's an appropriate assumption. It may be the truth from time to time, possibly. But I think the other explanation makes more sense. And I've used this example with you multiple times. If my phone were to suddenly ring, and I picked it up, and I, hello? Yeah. Randy, it's your mom. And I did that with my phone. Would you think that I was saying that the phone was your mom? No. Because you know this is just a conduit through which your mom can speak to you. That's the way servants were thought of. Servants were tools. Servants were conduits. And so when a servant representing a master was delivering a message, they would speak in the first person. Yes. Yes. Or yeah, not just simply sign language people, but interpreters of any language in a diplomatic setting. When the interpreter is doing all the talking in your language, you're not even supposed to look at them. You're supposed to be looking at the person that's talking to you through that person. That person is just a tool. Angels are servants of God. So they are tools that talk. And when angels appear and speak on behalf of God, they use first person. And so that's exactly what we see here. So this might be Gabriel for all we know. But the angel says this, I will greatly multiply your seed so that they will be too many to count. Does that sound familiar again? That was the promise made to Abram already, right? And here inside of Hagar is a seed of Abraham, or Abram at this time. And so the promise is going to be kept through this child, even though this is not the child of the promise. So the promise will be kept through the child, but the child is not the child of the promise. This is a Romans 8:28 principle passage, where God is able to make all things work together for good to the people that will love him, especially when it's going to accomplish his purposes. So even though Sarai and Abram jumped the gun and assumed some things here that they shouldn't have assumed, they still brought this child into existence through their actions. This child is a son of Abram, and therefore will encapsulate the promise of blessing. I will bless those that bless you and curse those who curse you, and you will be a blessing and your children will be a blessing and all of that. So Hagar's boy will be blessed by God. But there needs to be more information. The angel of the Lord said to her further, behold, you are with child and you will bear a son. Now, she didn't know that up to this point, did she? Because back in this time, they had no means that was legitimate as to how to determine the gender of the baby until the day of the birth. It was always going to be a big surprise. But the angel, at God's direction, says, by the way, the child will be a boy. And you're going to give him a name. You shall call his name Ishmael, because the Lord has given heed to your affliction. Now, that's my New American Standard there, has given heed, but it's literally has heard. So, where's my little clicker? By the time the baby's born, we'll move to the next year, so Abraham will be 86. But the name Ishmael literally means God hears. El, E-L, is the generic term for God in the ancient languages. You remember the Emmanuel has the E-L ending on the end? Okay, that's God. So Ishmael, Yishma, means heard or hears. So this baby boy has a special name to be a reminder always to Hagar. I'm listening. I'm listening to what's going on in your life. Did he hear whenever Sarai was giving her a hard time? Yeah. And if she'd spoken up to God about it, God might have been able to step in and do something about it. But she apparently didn't talk to God about it either. But God is still hearing. God is listening. You need to keep this in mind later, because she's going to make this same trip later and get lost. And she will think that she and her boy are both dead. But the story then goes on and says, but God heard and stepped in and saved them. So God's always listening. And this young man's life starts with a reminder, God is paying attention to what's happening in your life, and is an invitation for him and for mom to reach out to God on a regular basis. Verse number 12. He will be a wild donkey of a man. Now that's a funny term there, right? Now they did have wild donkeys, that's true. And the word for wild donkey is the word that gets used here in the Hebrew. But the word can also mean person of the country. And you can kind of see that, right? Where do wild donkeys live? Out in the country, out in the wild, right? So when the Hebrew speakers translated the Hebrew into Greek, and they knew Greek as well, 3 centuries before Jesus, they didn't use the word for donkey at all. They used the word for country. So basically, he's going to be a country guy. Now, what are Bedouins? When you think of Bedouins, what do you think about them? Nomads. So they're not city folk, are they? They live out in the wild. They live out in the country, right? And so I think that's exactly what's being said here, is that he's going to end up being a country guy, a Bedouin. But he's going to be an interesting character, and he's going to set the tone for a culture. The next part of the prophecy is, his hand will be against everyone, and everyone's hand will be against him. So is he going to be the type of guy that always helping everybody out regardless of who they are? Or is he more of limiting his connections? He's trouble if you're not part of his inner circle. He can be a bad boy. Well, it's interesting. When I was doing my research this time around, I didn't see this, but I've never seen this before, so this is brand new stuff to me. There is a widely quoted Bedouin saying, Are you ready for it? Here it is, quote, "I'm against my brother. My brother and I are against my cousin. My cousin and I are against the stranger," end quote. Now, isn't that interesting? The Bedouins, there's like, I don't know how many tens of millions of them that live in the Middle East nowadays. Their culture is the idea of the closer you are to me in relationship, that's what counts. The farther out you get, I'm not so much committed to you. In fact, if I can take advantage of you, I might. And you can almost appreciate that in a culture where everything you eat and drink has to come out of a wilderness that is very dry and non-productive. So here's God's prophecy that we have a saying amongst the Bedouins that most certainly at least some of them were descended from this man. It came to pass exactly as he said. And then the last thing there in verse 12 is, "And he will live to the east of his brothers." Now that's, I think, the proper understanding of it. But the literal wording is, "He will be in the face of his brothers." But this gets back to the perception of directions in the Middle East, even to this day. The ancient Middle Eastern people faced the sunrise. I mean, because they start their day as the sun comes up over the horizon. So that was the front. The right hand was to your right, and that would be south. Left hand would be the north. Behind you would be the west. So when it says here, he will be in the face of his brothers, it seems to be in mind that he's going to be living primarily to the east of his brothers. That's the Saudi Arabian peninsula. And that's where a very large portion of the Bedouins live, is out in that area. And that's east of the Promised Land. And his brother, Ishmael's brother, is going to be Isaac, who will be the one that gets the Promised Land. So that makes good sense as to where they're all going to live. Okay, any questions up to this point? Anything at all? Okay, so this is how we'll finish. Little bit more from the angel, or from God, or about God. Then she called the name of the Lord who spoke to her. "You are a God who sees." See, she just got told the name, the boy, God hears, right? And so she says, "God sees." For she said, "Have I even remained alive here after seeing him?" If you were to meet the angel of the Lord, would that scare you? Yeah, probably, right? What if your culture had also told you that God or the angel of God only shows up to punish you? What would you think your chances were the moment you saw the angel? Oh no, I'm a dead person, right? And we actually see that in some of the Bible stories. The one that I love the most, the mom and dad of Samuel. Angel of God appears to mom-to-be, and lets her know you're going to have a baby. Goes away. Husband finds out about it. Prays to God. "You sent a man." He thinks it's a prophet. "You sent a man to talk to my wife. Would you please send him back?" And so the angel appears to him as well. And he's like scared to death. by meeting this angel. And after the angel passes the same message on to him, he's like saying to his wife, we're going to die. We're going to die. We've seen God's angel. And she's like, don't be stupid. He said we're going to have a baby. Why would he kill us? Right? Now, she didn't say stupid, but that was basically what she was intimating. And she was correct. It's like, dude, think about it. Why would God kill you when he just told you he was going to give you a baby? It was very common practice. When Zechariah saw the angel in the temple building, was he happy or scared? He was scared big time. And possibly because he thought that he'd done something wrong and that he might have been struck dead for that. And he's told, don't be afraid. Your prayer has been heard. Now, let me tell you about what I've come here to tell you about. Another baby story. So, she says, I've seen God or God's angel, and I'm still alive. So that's a pretty big deal. So, therefore, the well, the little water thing that she was at, was called Bir. That's the Hebrew word for water source. Bir Lahairoi. Behold, it's between Kadesh and Bered. And that literally means the water source of the living one who sees me. And I love that name. And we don't know exactly where it's at. It's somewhere about a day's walk south of Hebron, something in that neighborhood. And eventually, it'll be a place that Isaac hangs out at. It'll become one of his favorite places to encamp whenever he's taking care of his sheep. And so the rest of the story is that Hagar bore Abram a son, had that whole birth lap thing going on probably, and Abram called the name of his son whom Hagar bore Ishmael. Now don't overthink this. How did he know what to call the boy? Because Hagar must have told the story. Now, do you think she only told it to him? No, probably told it to Sarai as well. And so these three now are kind of, they're partners in all of them trusting that God is going to keep his promises, going to do great things in their family. And so Abram was 86 years old when Hagar bore Ishmael to him. And when we come back to chapter 17 next week, you'll see that the first line says, Abram was 99 years old. So for the next 13 years, we don't have any stories, none. What happened during that time? Well, I can surmise what probably happened. They settled into a pattern that I already kind of described to you earlier, where Abram was raising Ishmael as his heir, and Sarai was treating him as her son, with Hagar right there. It was a team approach of raising him. And that will suddenly change in the next big story. And I'd really love to know some of the things that happened during this time. Because, you know, he's going to be 13 years old by the time we get to our next story. Abram's taken him out there and shown him how to hunt and take care of the animals and do this and that and the other thing. So he has certainly developed a very, very intimate relationship with Ishmael. Do you think maybe he's taught him things about God? Oh, yeah. Told him all the stories. So we will later see Ishmael kind of separated from all this, but I think you need to keep in mind that he spent the formative years of his life being taught by Abram and Sarai and his mom Hagar. And I believe he was a believer in the true God, and I have every expectation to be able to meet him in eternity. That's my belief. We'll see. He was not the son of the promise. And so the next story is going to start building up for when the son of the promise comes in. Questions or comments real quick? Yes, ma'am. That is exactly correct. Very good of you to know that. When Abram dies, and Abraham later dies, both his sons come and put him in the tomb of Machpelah, which means that they must have had an ongoing relationship. Both of them respected and honored Dad, even though they grew up, you know, separately from one another. We'll find out later that Ishmael will be living a couple of days' journey to the south and east of Hebron and of Beersheba. That doesn't mean that they couldn't have had interactions with each other during all those years. I think some people write off Ishmael, and I don't think we should. He is a very important figure in this story of faith. And even though he was not intended to be the heir, and they kind of jumped the gun on everything, he still ends up becoming a beloved son of Abram. And I think even of Sarai, honestly. Sarai will be the one that says, I want them out of my house, or out of my tent, out of my tent city. But that's the reason for it is, I'm getting ahead of the story a little bit here, is because she says these words, I will not have him be the heir in front of my son. Because it's something that happened at the third birthday party for Isaac. That's a story for later. Okay? Let's pray. Father, thank you for the time we get to spend in your scripture and seeing all these real people acting in real ways and knowing that you were always taking those free will choices and folding them together and weaving in other opportunities to finally bring about your plan of in the seed of Abraham blessing all the peoples of the world that would be trusting of you like Abraham was. We thank you for Jesus, and we thank you for salvation. And we pray that you'd help us to live in that salvation in such a way that other people can't help but get excited by what they see in us. And help us always be ready to give an answer when people ask us about that. Thank you for Pentecost that's coming up on Sunday. And thank you for your Holy Spirit guiding us in all ways. It's in the name of Christ we pray. Amen.